Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. There is a better way to practice architecture. When you build a thriving business, you will then have the time and the financial resources to do your best work, to design the architecture that you want to design. We've built a powerful program of resources, training, and community for you, the small firm architect. We'll show you how to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Entree Architect Academy. To learn more, visit the homepage at entrearchitect.com. You're listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 185. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. More control, more money, more happy clients, more architecture with better design. Is design build the answer to our profession's problems? Will building your own projects be the solution to success for your small firm? On this episode, I've invited two design build architects, one based on the West Coast of the United States and one on the East Coast, to come talk to me here on the show about what it takes to run a successful design build architecture firm. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, the passion, the process, and problems of running a design build architecture firm. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, Core by BQE Software, and Arcat. And I'm going to share more about these great companies later in the show, but before we get started here, just take a quick note to schedule some time later today, as soon as you're finished listening here, to go visit each one of them and let them know that you appreciate them for supporting us, the Entree Architect community. Jim Zack and Declan Keefe, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark. It's Jim. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, Jim and Declan have both been here before, so welcome back. Both are design build architects, and both are developers designing, building, owning their own projects. A few weeks back, Jim Zack reached out to me with an idea, and his idea was to maybe reach out to Declan, who's been on the show before. Have the three of us come together here on the Entree Architect Podcast and have a conversation about design build architecture. And so I think it's a great opportunity. I'm looking forward to this. Going to be an interesting conversation because, for one, you're on two separate coasts. I know your business models, and I think your business models are different. But you're ultimately shooting for the same goal. You're both looking to succeed in design build architecture. And so I think it'll be a very interesting conversation. Let me just do a quick intro of each of you for the people who don't know who you are. Jim Zak is based in San Francisco, California, and he is the co-founder and partner at his design build firm, Zak DeVito Architecture. He was here before at episode 102 back in December of 2015. It was called Risks and Rewards with architect developer Jim Zak. Jim is also a panel member on a live program that I organized last year for the CRAN Symposium in Sonoma, California. Unfortunately, CRAN was just canceled this year. It was based in Miami this year, and because of the hurricanes, it got canceled. So that was disappointing. But we had a really great panel last year talking. It was called Behind the Design, and we talked about some great architecture and then how the business works behind the architecture. And Jim is also a current facilitator at Entree Architect Academy. He's the facilitator for the design build group. So if anybody's interested in joining that group, we have a couple of seats open for that group. If you're interested, just reach out to me personally, find my email and request, and maybe we can get you into that mastermind group. Declan Keefe, he is a founding member and an owner at Place Taylor, which is a design build architecture firm based in Boston, Massachusetts. And this is Declan's fourth time. That might be a record. I'm not sure. I think somebody else may have also been on fourth time, but I think may have been just three. You may be the first one to do four times. Episode 130, 134, and 141 back in 2016. How to build a successful architecture firm that works, how to get started as an architect developer, and how to build a brand that resonates with your most valuable clients. Those are very powerful, really informative episodes. So I do encourage people to go back to listen to those. So we're not going to do origin stories because obviously you've been here before. If people wanted to know your origin stories and how you got started in architecture and your journey to get to where you are now, go back to those episodes and listen to them, and you can learn Jim's and Declan's origin stories. Instead of that, let's talk about your firms. Let's talk about how your design-build firms are structured and how you practice design-build architecture, because I think there's different ways of doing it. So let's start, Jim. Let's start with you and maybe describe how your firm works, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I won't go too far back with the origin story, but I will just say that I've been involved in building things for a long, long time. I've been in business 25 years. I'm 57, going on 58, and started working in construction when I was probably around 15, and was trained as a carpenter long before I was an architect. Built houses before I was an architect. So designed some houses before I was an architect. So I kind of go a long way back. And in my mind, sometimes I feel like I've failed at a few attempts to stop building and really fully grasped it and said we're going to be construction and design. So we're organized as two different companies. It's a big topic that comes up in the group that that I'm facilitating. How people organize their companies is interesting. I feel like I'm always interested in a bit of a fan of how other people do this. And I've found that the way we're organized is probably the most common, is that you have two companies, and one's a construction company, one's an architecture firm. And I feel like most architects who decide to build end up that way. I think a lot of liability issues, contract issues, financial issues kind of lead to that separation. So we have two companies. The way I think about it is that we're operationally a single entity to the client. We want them to feel like it's a seamless level of service, but we have two contracts, two bank accounts. They write checks to two different companies. Insurance is with two companies. In California, we have some interesting things where a few things actually overlap. The state determines that we're in a similar industry with similar business ownership. So they think that we have a similar operation in things like workers' comp. And I have one state tax ID number, even though I pay two separate tax bills, which is really interesting. Our workers' comp is single. Our health insurance is single. Our 401k is single. So there's kind of interesting interrelationship. So the technical setup is like two companies. Operationally, we try to make it one company. Year in and year out, it's always pretty interesting in that architects come to the office and sit at their desk and draw, and carpenters are out on the job site. And as much as we like to think that it's this nice meshing of things, I don't know that we're that much different than when it's separate sometimes. And it'd be interesting to get Declan's take on that. But I try really hard to integrate the two. And at the end of the day, carpenters are carpenters and not architects, and vice versa. So it's an interesting one. We do try hard to make our clients feel like it's seamless. We have project managers. I have an estimator slash project manager, and I have a full-time project manager. I have a partner in my construction company, Bruce Wickstrom, which is actually at this point the informal partnership, but we're working towards actually formalizing that, giving him some percentage of the company. It should be done by the end of the year. And then we have 6 to 10 carpenters, and some very senior that are more supervisory, and then some that are just carpenters. And on the office side, we typically are 5 to 8 people in the office. Have an interior designer on staff. My wife's my partner. She doesn't work a lot on projects. She's does a lot of kind of marketing and helps manage the office, but kind of works part-time. Full-time office manager, which is great. Kind of bookkeeper office manager, which a small architecture firm would never be able to afford. And it's a really wonderful thing to have. Gives us a lot of freedom. Takes that pressure off of me to order paper and do that kind of thing, as well as, you know, he deals with the higher level issues, insurance and payroll and all that stuff. It's really quite wonderful. So from a design standpoint, we're definitely pretty hardcore modernists, I guess you'd say, as much as we can. And we have, our clients come to us because we do that kind of design. And our construction staff knows how to detail what we do, which is very helpful. And that kind of, I think that seamless nature, my partner Bruce is really, really adept at kind of the modern detail. And a lot of times we don't have to detail things. He gets it. He knows what we want to do. And kind of detailing the field sometimes is pretty interesting. So that's kind of the general makeup of our company. We're, you know, 10 to 15 people, sometimes 15, 20. And two companies technically operate and try to make it seamless.
All right. How about you, Declan? How are you structured? Give a little description of how Place Taylor works.
So we are set up two differently, although technically our architecture and construction are formally one business. And our development entity is actually usually the separate business. And so really the scale of our businesses are almost identical. Almost all of the same roles you described is the way we're set up. We don't have that nice office manager, so I do get to order the paper. but we are actually, that is a role that we're looking to fill now because of exactly what you described. It's one of the benefits of having the revenue coming in through construction, which you just don't have coming through architecture. And it's less about profit of either business and more about the fact that you can just cash flow.
Exactly.
Office manager is just so much more money flowing through the business on the construction side than the architecture side. So we're set up that way for a couple reasons. One, because our business really came from a true design build model where we weren't actually doing any design for any other firm. And it was all products we could do internally, and our insurance allowed that and all those things. It's very different when you switch from designing internally to designing for other builders. So in the last year and a half or so, we've switched over to doing architecture that we're providing for other builders to build. And so even though we're still one business, we do functionally work as architecture, construction, and then real estate development as three arms of the business is how we look at it. Even though two of them are the same business. In addition to that, part of the reason that we're keeping them that way is that our business is also structured as an employee-owned cooperative. And so because of that, we want the people who are owners of our business to be able to own both of those portions, both the architecture and the construction portions. However, we separate out development because development has a much higher level of risk involved, and there's a lot more likelihood that on the development side that not everybody who is a co-owner of the business would want all of the developments. So we allow them to opt in to be in our development projects, but they don't have to be. And generally, it comes down to just a couple of us are the owners of the development entity, and then everybody else who's a co-owner of the business owns the architecture and construction side.
So how did you, and we went into this a little bit with both of you in the original episodes that we've done, but I think one of the questions that people will have with this episode is how and why did you start with design build? I know Jim has a passion for building, but was there a trigger point for both of you that you decided to go from architecture to architecture design build, or were you always all in on design build? Jim, you want to answer that first?
For me, it's just been an evolution. I'm entrepreneurial by spirit. I'm serious. I literally did a design build development project with my dad when I was 23. I was doing literally the first architecture class I ever had in my life. And my dad presented me with this opportunity to help him do a project. Said, if we, you know, help me design and build these two houses and you can have one when we're done. And I was like 23 years old in junior college. And then I eventually went to architecture school, and when I graduated undergraduate, I bought a house and remodeled it instead of working for somebody. And I went to graduate school, and I finished graduate school, and I got opened an office and started doing work, and did more work making things for people. Some things I designed, some things I didn't. And within a year or two, that just led to architecture projects that we built, and it's just what I knew how to do. And didn't really question it too much for most of the time. I think started my business in 91, somewhere in the mid-90s, I think I was starting to feel a little, I wanted to be a cool, designy, modern architect, and I didn't want to get my hands dirty. And I'm not quite sure in the mid-90s that design build had quite the cachet that it does now. You know, every young student coming out of design school wants to build. And I think I was pretty conscious of, like, I just want to be an architect, you know. And in the late 90s, .com time, you know, if you think about it, I'm kind of at the middle of the technology revolution geographically. And we were turning down work on a weekly basis. We were so busy in the run-up to the .com times. And so we didn't build for a couple of years, and that was somewhat conscious. But quickly kind of fell back into it. I had a client that asked me to get involved in it. I actually asked him, and he was designing a two-unit building, and he told me he wanted to partner. I'm like, I'll partner with you. And we ended up getting hold of the whole building, and that kind of started us back on a path of saying we're going to, you know, really do design build. And a lot of it over the years has been self-motivated projects. We design and build and sell buildings that we own. And the more we did that, the more we realized we should be doing this for our clients as well. And so the last 10 years, we've really made a conscious effort to build the construction side of what we do. So it's just been an evolution. But it was never a point in time when I said, oh, we're going to go from being an architect to doing design build. It's kind of was there from the first day.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Declan?
Ours was there from the beginning, actually. That was really the reason the business was started, was that we saw that in the industry there was this split between architects and builders that was leading to lower quality buildings and lower quality design. And we thought that doesn't actually have to be the way it is. And especially in Boston, I think this happens in urban areas for whatever, at least in New England, there's fewer design build companies here. And it happens more when we go further north into more of the rural areas in New England, where we're starting to see design build. And we said, well, we can actually bring that model, actually still use it in an urban area, because we can reference the master builder model of yesteryear. And so that's where we started, was let's just create higher quality buildings. Higher quality buildings very quickly for us translated into high performance, energy efficiency, and modern design. And that's sort of what launched us, was really the energy efficiency side. That's when we started to get clients, was when we started to get some press around the extreme energy efficiency that we were doing in our buildings. And development came from the fact that we started our business in 2008, and there wasn't a huge amount of work actually at that time. And so it was 2011. We said, well, we've made it this far, but there's not a lot coming in still, not regularly. How do we deal with that? Well, we can be the guys to take the risk and create our own project. And so that's when development started for us, which was around the time that I actually took over the business. I was there from the beginning, but I took ownership a few years in. And the decision was partly to create our own work doing development, but even more so, it was about creating a demonstration to other developers so that developers would hire us to do design build work. And if we could prove a business model for them, they would then hire us to do the work we actually want to be doing, which is design build, or now architecture and construction, because now they can come to us and just hire us to do architecture if they've got their builder they want to stick with. Or often what's happening these days is we're doing some development consulting with them saying, hey, this is how we did it in the last one, and this is how we were successful doing that. And do high performance building and do modern design and be able to differentiate in a market that they have not been able to do over the course of their careers. And so there's some development consulting mixed with the natural architecture and sometimes construction that goes along with making those things happen. And when we finally get buy-in from a developer, often it's they want all of it. And that's really what we want to be able to offer is the turnkey. You find the deal, you bring the money, we do everything else. And that's often what we're seeing when we're working with developer clients now, which is not all of our clients, but between our own developments and working with other developers, it's probably 80% of our work is somehow tied to development.
Interesting. So, do either of you have questions for one another? Because I have some other questions too.
I was just going to just comment about like working for developers and that we have developer clients we've designed for, but we've never been able to build for them. And it bothers me sometimes. And I think, boy, we should really be trying to get that guy to hire us. But then I realize it's like they're developers. They want to pay as little money as possible. And I don't want to be a cheap contractor. And we don't do cheap projects. We do sort of upper middle class. But, this is San Francisco. So upper middle class is a $1 million project. And barely even upper. It's just that's middle class in the Bay Area. So I kind of got over the idea that we're going to build our developers' projects. We'll do our own. And they want to build cheap, and I don't want to build cheap. So my question for Declan is more about the employee-owned business and how that really works, because I've heard you talk about that on previous podcasts, but kind of really understanding that. It's an interesting idea.
Do you want to give a brief scenario on how that works?
Sure. So employee-owned cooperative, the basics of it are that when someone becomes an owner, they are an equal part owner, meaning that they have equal equity stake and an equal vote, which is different than just having a partnership where you could set whatever percentage of ownership and you could give a certain percentage of equity or profit sharing. This actually says that if you're going to be an owner in our business, we're going to give you equal stake. So everybody's on the same playing field. And it becomes part of how we have to hire, because everyone that comes into our company as an employee, if they stick with us for 3 years and our cooperative, so the owners of the business, believe that they're meeting a certain line of criteria, which pretty much they always will if they've lasted for 3 years, then they can become an owner too, which means we're all giving up a percentage of our ownership to allow the next person to come in. So right now, there's five of us who are owners. We have a sixth coming in January who's already accepted our offer to become an owner, and so we're doing that transition. And then, there's another, I think at this point, another six people in the company who, if they stick around long enough, I guess there's five that if they stick around long enough, they can come on. One has decided not to for his own choice, and they don't have to come on as owners. And so what that really means is that ownership decisions, which we have to define much more clearly because we need to have a break between management and ownership. And because we're not making every decision amongst all of the owners about, which type of paper are we buying or what design decision here or there. That needs to happen just as it could happen in any firm. For us, largely is things related to overall company budgets get approved by all of the owners, any other major purchases, if we're changing a policy, if we're changing benefits. We approve essentially a salary pool, so not total pay for each person. That happens by me, the strategic director, but we do get to decide this is how much we're putting out in pay this year, or projecting to put out if we're planning to hire or if we're going for growth or not. And so all of those decisions in our business are based on a consensus model. So we have to have everybody who's an owner to be on board with all of the decisions related to ownership. We do have language in our bylaws that says if we can't, and there's a sort of a series of things that describes what it looks like when you really can't, then ultimately the strategic director, which right now is me, gets to have essentially a sway vote. So we gets to pick which direction it goes, which we've not had to do yet, luckily. So that's the basics of it. The benefit to the employee is they get to have a say in the business that they're a part of, an equal vote say. I mean, essentially a veto say, because until unless we have to go to the point at which I'm vetoing something, any one person can stop a consensus. So really have a lot of say in the way the business is directed. And then if we're doing well, they get an equal share of the profits. And even that, but we decide as an ownership team, what percentage of the total company's profits are distributed to the owners and what percent just stay in the business. So it's not like all profit gets distributed immediately to ownership. And the way that that also works is 50% of, this is currently how it works for us at least, 50% of whatever percent of the total profit of the company goes to the employee owner as cash, and 50% stays in the business as dividends. And so the business can actually use that for leverage, but it's actually a paper account that technically is owned by and paid taxes on by the employee, and that when they leave, they get all of that money out of the company. So, yeah, that's the overview of employee ownership.
Do the employees buy in? I mean, they have to pay for their percentage of ownership?
It's essentially nominal. I mean, at this point, given where we are in the business and the revenue we're bringing in, it's around $5,000 to buy into the business. It's really to say, I'm willing to put some money down, and I've thought about it enough over the last year to have $5,000, you know, like
it's also like nothing that has value is free, right? It's the whole conversation that you charge for the first meeting, you know.
Yeah.
If you put it away, then it's got no value. So
let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect: BQE Software, Arcat, and FreshBooks. This podcast episode is sponsored by BQE Software, the makers of BQE Core. Core puts time and expense tracking, billing, project management, and accounting together on one beautiful, powerful platform. Whether you're at the office, at home, or on site, Core allows you to seamlessly monitor projects and tasks, track time, send invoices, and get groundbreaking insights. Get your fully functional 15-day trial of Core by going to entrearchitect.com/BQE. Hey, and if you want to see a demonstration of Core, I recently invited Stephen Burns of BQE Software to join me for a live Entree Architect special session webinar, where Steve had the opportunity to show us inside Core and all it has to offer us small firm architects. And a recording of that webinar is available to our community, the Entree Architect community, for free at entrearchitect.com/BQE webinar. So go check that out. And when you're ready to give it a try, visit entrearchitect.com/BQE and access your fully functional trial of Core free for 15 days. Hey, if you've been listening to this podcast anytime during the past few months, you've heard me talking about our friends over at Arcat, and hopefully you're already using their free resources on a regular basis. But for those of you who have not yet checked them out, Arcat is a great tool for small firm architects. Arcat has a huge library of free content, CAD, BIM, specifications, and more, and they've done all the work for you. I mean it. They've done all the work. If you need a spec, click on over and download a CSI three-part specification in multiple formats, free. How about CAD details or BIM objects, all free, click of a mouse. ARCAD has tons of building product content ready for you to use, and it's all completely free. You don't even have to register to download the content. And they've recently launched something new. It's called Charette. Create a project, assign tasks, share and collaborate with colleagues and clients, all in real time. Pull content directly from the ARCAD database or from anywhere out on the web and keep it in Charette. It's another free resource from ARCAD for you, the Entree Architect community. Visit them right now. Go check them out. EntreeArchitect.com/ARCAD. That's A-R-C-A-T. EntreeArchitect.com/ARCAD. And click on the Charette icon right there on the homepage to check out Charette. Imagine what you can do if you had an additional 2 days every month to dedicate to anything that you want. Maybe you just want to spend more time on design. Maybe you want to start building that new business process. Maybe you want to start painting again. Maybe you want to spend more time with your kids. Or maybe you want to finally start that development project. Well, when you're a small firm architect using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, you could save 192 hours every month. That's 2 business days every month. That's the amount of administrative time that you could save this year if you're using FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses, automatically track your time for the whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature of FreshBooks is the automated email reminders sent to my clients to remind them to pay their bills. That's done automatically, and you control the whole thing. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit EntreeArchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. BQE Software, ARCAD, and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So one of the questions that I often hear, because like Jim said before, so many architects want to do this design build model. I think I would say even the majority now, you know, not necessarily want to pursue it, but sort of dream of the idea of having the control over their own projects. But getting started as an architect that's already a practicing architect, both of you have started that way, that it was, you know, intentional to start design build firms. If you had a young architect come to you who is an architect and has an opportunity to build their own project or manage the construction of it and sort of work their way slowly into design build, what sort of advice would you give to somebody like that? Do you prescribe that they do sort of take baby steps and maybe start with construction management and then work their way up to design build? Or is it just sort of an all-in or don't even try it sort of scenario?
I guess I'll go first. It's a tough one, and I think there's a lot of different answers, and it depends on the market, depends on the person, depends on their background, their experience. And, you know, for me, it's an overused term these days, but, you know, I'm a maker when I can be. And unfortunately, these days it's not very often, but it's in my bones, and I make things, and I like to make things. And the motivation to build is as much that you just like to be involved in the making of this stuff as opposed to letting someone else do it. So you have to make a decision on the front end. Are you a builder or are you a manager contractor? And, you know, we want to be builders. We've decided that we don't want to transition to the point where we're just managing a bunch of subcontractors. And one of the members of our ASG group is a company in Texas, and they have no blue-collar employees. You know, they're just project managers. But they're really a construction company. They have a contractor's license. And I think that's a key question, is that, are you getting a contractor's license? Or are you trying to do this, what I call not at risk? You know, if you have a contractor's license, you can be a project manager at risk, so to speak. You could choose to not have any construction employees and you're effectively managing subcontractors. But I think the main difference is the money flows through your company or not. I know there's a lot of companies that are set up that want to start managing construction, a lot of design companies, they want to start managing construction, but they're effectively managing owner-builder projects. They're setting it up so that their client takes all the risk, their client signs all the contracts, and they'll just sort of assist them through that process. And it's an interesting idea. I think there are some people doing it quite well. I think the build guys in Seattle do it that way. They've kind of created a network of subcontractors, and they've actually supported carpenters to become licensed so that they can then work as subcontractors to the clients. And so they're sort of never at risk. The money doesn't flow through your company, but, you know, so we're organized. Yeah, we get all the money. It's like Declan says, it's like it generates the cash flow. Is that, you know, we are a contractor. We create the subcontracts, and the client pays us to pay other people, and we skim our profit off the top, so to speak. So that's the big decision in my mind, is that you want to be a builder or you want to actually just manage other people. And it really kind of does depend on your experience and expertise and whether or not you can pull together the resources to actually make things and build.
What about you, Declan? What would you say to that person who wants to start?
I think if it's a young architect who's working on their own and they're doing it just to have control, then they're doing it for the wrong reason already. It's not just about having control. That means you're not able to do the job of an architect, which is communicate and facilitate and manage. And I wouldn't use design build model as a cop out for having the skills to do what this career actually is. And so I'd say you can do it because it's the business model that you believe in and represents the way in which you want to work. So I would start by saying that. And then what I would follow up with is, if you're doing your first small project, and maybe this is just because this is how I started, but I think the experience of swinging the hammer and doing each of the dirty jobs along the way is so valuable in terms of understanding what it actually means to do design build in the way that Jim was describing it, is actually as the builder. And I think making that leap from architect to manager of construction, I think you're actually going to make the things that are worse even worse. Because now you think you're good enough just because you're an architect to go manage the guys in the field who I'm certain know more than you about what they're doing out there. And so if you want to actually be able to manage them, you've got to do the things they've done to know what's hard, what's not hard, what does it cost to do that, why am I making this decision or not making that decision. And to me, that's really where I got so much value, was being in the field and spending the time, you know, digging the ditch and swinging the hammer and fixing the thing I did wrong, until the point at which then I could manage people who were making those mistakes also. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a full career as a carpenter and then transition, but I spent maybe 4 years in the field, and I started managing during some of that. And it was enough to understand what it's like to be in the culture of carpentry. And so that's what if it's possible and you're willing, that's what I would say is, you know, find someone who's willing to bring you under their wing and do some carpentry, even if it's your own design project, but don't try to lead it yourself. I'd say, get in there and then do the next one or a couple down the line.
Working for Uncle Bob's construction company there, you know, the summer between third and fourth year of architecture school does not mean you'd learn how to be a carpenter. Yeah,
right. I get that a lot.
Yeah.
An experienced architect team up with an experienced contractor, and form a company and get that experience through that process, basically becoming, committing themselves to a partnership and maybe a third entity. And then having the contractor part of the partnership lead the construction, and that gives the opportunity to the architect to be out there and experience what they need to experience.
I think that could work. Yeah, I think it can work. You know, partnerships are a minefield too, so you have to just be careful about that. And but it definitely could work. I think what Declan said is, like, what's the motivation to do this? Mm-hmm. Why do you want to be involved in design build? And for me, it's very clear. I haven't figured out how to put this tagline on my website yet, but it's like, we design and build cool shit. And that's what I want to do, you know, and that's what I want to do day in and day out. And, and it's kind of just in the blood. So and we really do know how to build. I've been building for 40 years, so somehow or another, and whether I'm drawing it or actually swinging a hammer, I actually know how to do most of the stuff around residential architect and residential construction. So you know, we all know that architects don't need to know how to build to be great architects. I mean, you know, the architects designing the World Trade Center, most of them don't know how to build, and they're building and designing amazing stuff. So it's possible. But I think at the scale we're talking about, that hands-on construction experience is pretty important. But evaluating the motivations is pretty important. But partnerships can work. I think you just have to be really careful, because Declan said it. It's like you're kind of going to get yourself stuck in a cesspool that you're not really familiar with. And you know, the guys do know how to do what they're doing, and you know, if the motivation is, hey, I think the contractors make more money and I want a piece of it, it's kind of a good reason, but you better be careful, because there's just a lot to know about managing a construction company. And there's, you know, you think you have liability as an architect, you got a hell of a lot more as a contractor, you know, callbacks and leaks, and you know, they're more direct to the contractor than they are to the architect. So you have to be prepared.
Yeah, in terms of a business model itself, the construction arm of our company is so much more complicated than the architecture side. I mean, just if you're just looking even at a balance sheet or a income statement, the architecture firm, it's like you bill for your services and you pay for paper and you're done. You can kind of understand the entire extent of what an architecture. We have like 400 lines that we're tracking in our construction side of the business, and each one of those is looking at material, labor, subcontractors, and each one of them has its own calculator, which is a tool that's, you know, actually literally like 2,000 lines long in a spreadsheet, which is how to calculate each one of those things. And it's actually the case, this is what I show to folks when they just ask, you know, what's the price before we even start anything, is every single one of the cells in that, which literally is thousands of things, has taken someone years of experience to even know what should go in that cell. And so to just jump into it and say that you get it because you've designed the building and drawn the lines is misplaced. I'd also say, just sort of in line with the business models that Jim and Place Taylor's team has also, is if you're looking for control over the project, then I wouldn't even say that construction is the place for that either. That's more of the line of going towards being the architect as developer, because that's how you get control of a project. Construction is, if you're just doing architecture construction, you're still essentially bowing down to whomever it is you're doing the work for. Not necessarily in a bad way. Sometimes it's great to have a client and be the design builder, but if you're trying to dictate the aesthetic of the project or the approach to the project or even the social mission of a project, which is largely why we are doing development work, then that comes from the development side of things, or build your own house. You know,
that's true.
And so, this again goes back to, why are you doing it? And if you're doing it for that reason, you don't have to be the builder. You could be the architect developer and find somebody else to build it. Or you could just be the builder developer. Whatever the permeation is, I think just being aware of what strings which party gets to pull is pretty important. And for us, we think of it as I was talking about before, plug and play. So we can do each one of those things, but ultimately we're most valuable if you utilize the entire service of architecture, construction, and development all together.
What are some of the, I mean, we talked about how, you know, the cash flow is better and your designs are better and you have that control as a design builder. With those rewards, we talked a little bit, you just mentioned a few risks and the downside of being a design builder. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Do you guys have any stories of being a design builder and maybe at the time wishing you weren't? What are some of the risks of being a design builder?
Well, I think that, you know, just figuring out how to profit from construction in itself is a pretty difficult challenge. And I think that there's a naive attitude that, oh, you know, the contractor figures out his price and he puts his 10 or 12 or 15% markup at the bottom and he gets to walk home with a bonus into the job. And it's like, you know, as Declan says, it's taken us a long time to teach ourselves to actually manage our finances, and we're getting pretty good at it. We have a lot to learn still. But, you know, that 12 to 15% turns into, you know, 2% really fast. And overhead eats up a lot of it. And, you know, you can pay one person more than they're worth, and that eats into your bottom line. Pay yourself more than you should be getting at the front end, and it leaves nothing at the back end. So this, the financial management, is pretty challenging.
Declan, do you have any advice on that end?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that to build a building versus design it, there's so many more people involved. And when there's so many more people involved, you have to deal with all of the things that come with having people involved. So that means anything from the risk of having them up on scaffolding and tripping and falling to the emotions of two people who have different political views to... you know, whether they actually got the job because they're good at interviewing and then they show up and don't know what they're doing. You know, all of those things really matter, sort of in any business, but just when you multiply it by needing more people, you see it more. And that comes with construction. And with construction, it's really difficult on the hiring side when you actually are bringing carpentry staff inside to know whether they're good or not. No, you're not learning anything about a carpenter really by talking to them at the desk when you do an interview. You know, it's not until they actually get in the field and are working with your team that you know if they can do the job you just hired them to do. And so that's somewhat different when you're hiring designers, because you can see their work. You actually can see their total product, and you know that they're the ones that did that, and you're hiring them to do the same thing for you. So that is a, you know, just hiring for construction is a completely different.
It's different.
Difficult, and it's also the case that if you don't have the people, you actually can't do the work, and then it slows down, and now you've lost that 10%, right? You know, the project goes longer, and you're paying overhead for more months than you expected, and then it's gone. So every one of these little decisions or complications, which often are people-based, affect your bottom line, and knowing that that is the case is maybe even more important than the reality that that is the case.
Yeah, and the reality these days of being hiring anybody for doing about anything is so difficult that I mean, we look for weeks if not months at a time to hire one carpenter. We have so many challenges hiring people. We now have a two-week rule. We tell them when we hire them, it's like, you know, it's the second Friday you're here, just I'm going to tell you yes or no. And if it's no, here's your check, thanks a lot, you know. And if it's yes, you got two more weeks to prove yourself. And really, to be honest, you know, in about a week, but we give people 2 weeks, and we actually literally have let people go at the end of 2 weeks and just said, you don't fit. You're not who you said you are. You don't have the experience and the skills. And it is really difficult front end to determine that stuff.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, we've never really had, I guess we've had one pretty huge failure. When I think about it, I selectively forget this project, but of course it was doing someone a favor, which is rule number one, don't do favors. It was
how often does that happen?
Yeah. And then it was working for a friend, or technically it's the sister of a friend, was a good friend. Was the recession, and she burned her house down basically, and didn't have enough insurance money. And we started off just helping her rebuild it from a design standpoint. She was a pretty sweet lady, but pretty tough. And her husband was quite old. And it evolved into a design build project that, you know, we ended up in mediation and probably lost, you know, $75,000 or $80,000. That was 4 or 5 years ago, and I feel like I'm still paying that off, you know. it's a big chunk of money, and for a lot of reasons. And it's just, you know, we didn't manage it well. The guy working for me at the time as the project manager, you want to talk about people evolving into sort of realizing they're not very good. You know, we had a guy here for a year, year and a half before you realize he, you know, really doesn't know what he's doing. You know, it takes a long time. So things can go sideways pretty fast. And there's a lot, not to drag the story out, but, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of mistakes, I suppose, made. But at the time, they don't seem like mistakes. They seem like the right thing to do. So there is that risk of project going south, and the amount of money that you have at stake is a lot higher than, you know, when you're getting paid by the hour. You lost some time Maybe you paid an employee for a couple weeks of work, but usually you catch that pretty quickly. And in construction, you know, it's a different situation.
And you're relying on people in the field to do their best work and to do work that you expect them to know how to do.
Yeah.
And so you have to rely on other people to make some pretty big decisions, unless you're doing it yourself, right? And so an architect who's considering doing this has to take that into account too, that this is not just you, you know, starting a design build firm and saying, okay, now you're going to build and go hire a bunch of people and they're going to go do what they are supposed to do. With all the work that you're doing as an architect, you now quadrupled it with the amount of work that you're going to have to do on the design or the build side of it to make sure that you don't end up in a situation like Jim just described.
And, you know, I think what you just said about quadrupling the work, it's like I think both of us, we're wearing three hats. We have three businesses, right? We're designing, we're building, and we're developing. And the amount of time I spend on any one task kind of depends on what day of the week and what month of the year. But it's really easy to say that I am not an architect anymore. You know, that's the easiest one to say. And, yes, I you know, run the office. I am the guy in the driver's seat, but the amount of time I spend designing is, you know, next to nothing. And I learned a long time ago that we can still get a quality of design through management and you know, desk crits or whatever you want to call it. But the amount of time I personally spend designing is almost next to nothing. And so you've got to acknowledge that you can, you know, something has to give. As I've grown older and done this longer, I'm a lot, maybe a lot of people get to this point, but I'm excited by the business. I'm excited by growing the business and learning more about business. And it just happens that my business is architecture and construction. And so, you know, it took 25 years to know that I don't know very much. and there's still a lot to learn. So, but I think that if someone's interested in doing this, they have to acknowledge that, you know, you only have so many hours in a day and you can still hire people to do work, but you don't get to do the same things that you did if you're just doing design and doing architecture.
Yeah, I think similarly, the one thing to realize, sort of jumping back a little bit to the risk, is if you think about an architecture fee, many times, this is not how we actually price projects, but it's 5, maybe 10%. You can get a little higher than that if you're lucky, of the total construction cost. What that actually means is that that other 95%, if you're the builder, is now your risk too. So if you just think about, you know, risk mitigation as it relates to dollar value, the architect's taking that 5% risk. The builder, if you take on that role, is now taking the other 95% of the risk. So all of that money is actually at risk. Every time you're doing work, before you've received any of that money for that work, it's at risk. So that sort of just puts it in context of what we're really talking about here on a dollar value of differential between an architecture firm and construction.
Which may be a good argument for doing that project management not at risk, you know, right. Or set your client up to be an owner builder, which, you know, I've never really thought about that in depth, but I think there's some risk there too, because, you know, you are effectively counseling your client that you're kind of going to be their contractor, but then you're not. And I think that if a project went south and someone sued you, that you could really lose it because you're kind of acting as a contractor but didn't take the risk, weren't properly licensed and insured or whatever it is.
That's another thing that I've found over the years of the various different permeations of business is, because we have so many hats, you just really have to trust people more than you would in another business. And so I have someone who leads each one of those of the different arms of the business. So there's someone who runs the architecture division, who runs the construction and runs the development side. And I don't actually necessarily know everything that's happening in all of those projects that are coming. I mean, I know every project that's coming through, but I don't know what's happening in every project and part of every client interaction anymore. And you just have to have the right people and trust that they're going to be able to do their job. And if you're not willing to let go a little bit, you're not actually going to be able to do it because there's just too many pieces moving. So that's another one in terms of why are you doing this? Well, I happen to be, you know, similar to Jim. I love using the creative process to formulate a business model that allows us to do the work we want to do. And so I'm using the creativity and the process of sort of thinking through and problem solving that we learn in architecture and applying it to a business model. And I think that happens too little in too many industries, and even in our industry, it doesn't happen enough where we're thinking creatively about a business. And I think it's kind of interesting that the skill set of an architect is actually set up really well to think creatively about business. And yet we often see that people fall into the same business model because it's easy and we don't like to worry about numbers or change the spreadsheet that we were given by, you know, whoever showed us how to run an architecture firm. But you can do it differently.
It took me a while to realize that I could run my business on my terms, and I didn't have to be like everybody else. For the first 10 years, I was trying to be like everybody else. And that moment that I decided I can kind of do this my way was pretty pivotal. Not exactly sure what that is.
And I think that's very inspirational. I hope if our listeners get anything from our conversation today, I hope that they get that they should be looking at their businesses as a design project. That it's more than just a necessary evil, that it could be fun, it could be exciting, it could be part of, you know, the passion for what you have to do. Clearly a message of Entre Architect for a long time. So I'm glad to hear both of you say that your businesses and the way you do things, because you're obviously, both of you are doing things differently than the traditional architects out there. It sounds like it's because that's the passion you have. You have the passion to create these alternate models of business and these brands and these business models and these construction methods and the way you put together buildings. So thank you for sharing your knowledge and your inspiration. I want to end on a positive note, because we talked a lot about why not to do this. What would you say is the best part of being a design build architect? What is your favorite part? What gets you up in the morning to get up and get out there and do this? What is it about design build that gets you going?
I still just really enjoy the job site. I like going by my job sites, and I like seeing that development over time, from foundation to framing to sheetrock to finishes, and then just the final product. And so for me, it is just kind of goes back to being involved day to day in that construction at a level that's much more than you get as an architect.
Mine is similar, but maybe on the people side. I love having the team and the people who are doing the job in the field and the people doing it in the office and the investors we get to work with on the development side and all the various consultants from all of the different parts of the company. It's just a wide range of amazing people that we get to put together and work together to make things for the clients. Ultimately, even if we're doing development work, it's ultimately someone's going to live there, and that gets to be part of, you know, the big jolly family that, you know, you can be really separated from if you're siloed into one piece or another piece. And I love so much being able to facilitate bringing these people together and making something physical represent that family in the world in a building. So,
Zach DeVito, it's Zach DeVito Architecture, ZachDeVito.com, right?
Yes.
And PlaceTaylor.com, Taylor like the suit with an OR, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people can go check you guys out there. Jim and Declan, thank you very much for being here at Entre Architect Podcast and for sharing your knowledge here.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark.
If you liked what we shared here today and find value in anything that we're doing here at Entre Architect, I ask you to share this episode with a friend. Pick one friend, just one, that you think might benefit from what we talked about here today, and share this episode with them. Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode will be found at entrearchitect.com/episode185. That's the link to share, entrearchitect.com/episode185. And don't forget to visit the website to learn more about Entree Architect Academy. It's for you. It's our private online membership program that's built just for you, the small firm entrepreneur architect. You can build a better business. I promise you, we will show you how. To learn more, visit the homepage at entrearchitect.com. All the information's there. Come join us. You won't regret it. You will love it. The members who come and join Entree Architect Academy don't ever leave. They come in and they love what we're doing and they find value and they find camaraderie. Members share with one another. It is an amazing place. If you like the Entree Architect Facebook group, you will love Entree Architect Academy. Just find a member and ask them and they will tell you how much Entree Architect Academy has changed their life. To learn more, visit the homepage today at entrearchitect.com. All the information is right there on the homepage, entrearchitect.com. Hey, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.